It feels like every day, whether it's our favorite news program or mindlessly scrolling through social media, we are constantly seeing graphic footage of heinous crimes, shootings, carjackings, various assaults, and even murder. For many people, the current crime crisis we find ourselves in may feel like a fog, but I assure you, for many Americans who don't have the luxury of becoming desensitized, they live with it each day in fear of becoming a victim. The crime crisis has had a dramatic effect on our society, and those suffering the most are our vulnerable communities. Today, we're joined by Josh Crawford. Josh is the Director of Criminal Justice Initiatives for the Georgia Center of Opportunity, where he leads their public safety and reentry work. He has testified before local and state legislative committees and federal agencies and a presidential commission. I'm Patrick Gillis, National President of Fraternal Order Police, and this is The Blue View. Well, Josh, thank you for joining us on a Blue View podcast. Why don't you tell our listeners just a little bit about yourself?
Sure. Well, thank you for having me. I'm a lawyer and a prosecutor by training, but I joined the think tank world. I guess it's going on 7 years now, because what I experienced as a practitioner and a prosecutor was that very quickly, you learn to triage your caseload, right? On the one end of your cases, there are the people that they build prisons for, right? The really bad guys who prey on the vulnerable and make life in communities more difficult. On the other far end of the spectrum, you have the guy who truly made a mistake, right? Interaction with the system is enough to make sure that they never do that again. Here in Kentucky, I use the example of the guy who gets a DUI after the UK basketball game. He's terrified by the whole interaction. He's never going to do it again. You try to exit that guy from the system relatively quickly. The great swath in the middle are people who didn't make a mistake. They knew what they were doing, but maybe they've got some underlying issue, be it addiction, mental health, something like that. And you try to leverage the resources that you have and that the system has to try to get that person the help that they need. And you tailor it to the specifics of the individual. Sometimes that help needs to come within the confines of a prison. Other times it can happen in an outpatient capacity. And so the real attraction to the policy space is to take that reality that practitioners face, that law enforcement and prosecutors and judges face, and make sure that the policies reflect those realities.
So Josh, thanks thanks for the intro. So let's just dive right into it. You know, this is some strange times for our country. You know, we're dealing with a lot of issues. There's an evolution of a lot of different mindsets that are coming together, and as a result, law enforcement is kind of caught right in the crosshairs of all of this. But let's just talk about the reality of where we find ourselves as a nation. Last year, Gallup released a poll that found that 8 out of every 10 Americans are worried about crime. 53% said a great deal. 27% said a fair amount. Increased concerns over crime is followed with sharp violent crime itself. And especially, you know, homicides in the last 6 years. And 12 major cities saw the deadliest years on record. 2022 murder rates, wasn't far behind. In Chicago, there were 695 murders. Philadelphia, 504. New York, 418. Houston, 377. Los Angeles, 373. In 2022, Philadelphia surpassed 500 murders for the second year in a row and the third in their history. The violent crime is increasing by 50% in cities across this country, and something needs to be done. We need to recognize that the way we're doing things now is just simply not working. Now it's easy to I gave you a whole bunch of numbers, and if you total them all up, that is a whole lot of homicides just in a handful of cities. And it's easy. Numbers are impersonal. We look at numbers and say, okay, that sounds like a lot, but let's just not forget that every one of those is a person in a family that has been affected by violent crime. Can you share your thoughts about the current crime situation that we find ourselves in cities all across this country?
Yeah, absolutely. The truth is that we're in a pretty bleak space. If you look at graphing of homicide totals, so not rates, but totals, we have erased virtually all of the decline in homicides that took place from the mid-1990s through 2014. So the last several years, because of increases, it's basically become a U at this point. We've eliminated all of those declines. Now, rates are still lower because populations are larger. But we're entering now our eighth year of really kind of heading in the wrong direction. 2020 forward gets a lot of attention, but 2015 had a sharp increase in homicides. 2016 had a sharp increase in homicides. And in a lot of the same cities that you mentioned, you're not only seeing increases in homicides, but you're seeing increases in things like drive-by shootings. You're seeing increases in things like carjackings and armed robberies. New York City ended 2022 with a slight decline in homicides, but an overall increase in other major crimes. And so the homicides are starting to get some of the attention that they deserve, perhaps, but other major crimes, other serious violent crimes are up in a lot of these large metros, and they're up in a lot of jurisdictions that aren't used to dealing with this kind of violence, right? New York City, LA, Chicago, they get a lot of attention, but the cities that you're seeing the sharpest increases over the last couple of years are sort of mid-sized cities in the middle of the country. Louisville, Kentucky went from a city that averaged 54 homicides a year for 3.5 decades to last year having 188 murders. I mean, that's a nearly fourfold increase. Minneapolis, Minnesota, Milwaukee, Wisconsin, Little Rock, Arkansas, Birmingham, Alabama, these sort of mid-sized cities in the middle of the country are starting to see these increases, and they're really not used to dealing with that level of violence.
Right. No one's immune to it. That's for certain. It's definitely a trend we're seeing, you know, across this country. Why is that? You've been in the system for a while and you work it in a different perspective than I have in a law enforcement side of it, as an attorney. Give me your thoughts on how we've put ourselves on a trajectory for these last 8-9 years and how it has escalated, because it is. Now, although we've seen that trend go up, we can't argue the fact that the last 2-3 years have really escalated at a far greater pace than the previous years. What do you see as the driving factors of these things?
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things that folks don't really understand is how rational most criminal actors are, right? And by that, I don't mean that they make decisions the same. They don't come to the same conclusions that you or I would, perhaps because their information is less perfect than ours is. But they respond to the scenarios around them. When there's a heavy law enforcement presence, they're not going to commit a crime. When there's less of a law enforcement presence, they're more inclined to commit a crime. And what you've seen over the last several years are a remarkable number of policy changes, both in terms of legislation and departmental policy changes in police departments all across the country, some of which was well-intended response to COVID, right? Like the idea of sort of trying to slow the spread by having law enforcement interact with the community less is a well-intended policy that on its face really has nothing to do with crime. But when cops are less omnipresent in a neighborhood, the illegitimate means of controlling the neighborhood, oftentimes in the form of things like criminal street gangs, tend to rise up and tend to become more active. And that's what you're seeing all across the country. Crime, especially serious violence, is relatively concentrated among a relatively small number of offenders. And those guys got more active over this time period. It's not as if average Americans became more violent. It's that the people who are inclined towards serious criminal activity were able to do it more frequently.
You know, you look at the dynamics that COVID has put on society, and it's certainly created challenges that I don't think any of us. I can tell you that in my lifetime, I never expected to see the erosion, the things, the shutdowns, the way that a pandemic can affect a nation and not a world. That matter, and there's no question that that COVID has had an impact on socialization and a number of factors that are important. Just when we look at crime, but there's another factor and one that I think that bears some discussion on. You know, we can't control the fact that we had a pandemic. We can't control the fact that there were a lot of, you know, cause and effects that happened because of the action that had to be taken during that time. But at the same time, we've seen a lot of policy changes that have really, and not just policy changes coupled with relentless attacks on the profession of law enforcement have done two things. They have created a lack of respect for the position of law enforcement. Mm-hmm. But probably more important, they created a lack of respect or a lack of concern or even consequences associated with the rule of law and in fighting crime. I've been doing this job for more than three decades. And I do know this. I could tell you, and I think anybody who's been in law enforcement for a while will tell you that the reality is, and you even started off in the beginning of this segment saying that there are a number of people out there that just want to do damage. Mm-hmm. They're destructive. They're just programmed to be that way. The majority of crime in every community is committed by a very small percentage of people. And when we were able to impact that by taking them out of their ability to be able to prey on the public, then we impact crime. Right. We haven't been very successful in that because of these policies. So if we could, let's just talk a little bit about the knee-jerk reaction to events that have happened and the cause and effect that it's creating across this country and how it's contributing to crime and making our communities less safe.
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the mistakes that people make when they look at defund the police and this idea and this sort of social movement of defund the police was to interpret that as just about punishing law enforcement. There was some of that. There was absolutely an attempt to say, screw law enforcement, we're going to punish them by defunding the police. But underneath a lot of it is a true ideological belief that it is the systems and institutions that cause criminal behavior, not the individual. That if you were to tear away law enforcement, if you were to tear away the courts, if you were to tear away a lot of these structures and institutions, that we would genuinely be better off. Now, I think it's nonsense. I think it's a complete and utter nonsense philosophically. I think the data doesn't bear it out. In fact, communities, both in the United States, across the world, and historically, that have less access to the sort of legitimate means of justice tend to always be more violent communities. Self-help justice is always more violent than the official means of justice in communities. And so by denying communities official justice, legal justice, you are absolutely setting them up for failure. You're setting up for the violence and chaos of self-help justice. And so that's what you have seen take place in a lot of these communities that have adopted both the policies and the rhetoric coming out of the last couple of years. Defund the police has been successful, and I sort of use air quotes for that, in two ways. The first way has been some jurisdictions that have literally reduced police budgets, but the other is to create an environment in which it is remarkably more difficult to police. And a lot of my very close friends, people I go to church with, are law enforcement officers who now have sons who are 13, 14, 15 years old who come from sort of cop legacy families. And I know some of those fathers who are trying to discourage their sons from going into law enforcement because they look at the environment and say, I don't want that for my son. And those are the exact kind of people we want in law enforcement. I look at those young men and think they would be excellent police officers someday. But the truth is that the rhetoric and the policy change have sort of created this hodgepodge of terrible that has created this environment in some cities that has allowed crime to run amok.
You know, I want to come back to it. I do want to talk about the recruiting problem that exists in this country. And the reality is most law enforcement officers, I've done some research on this when I was in college, I did a paper on it. And I think that even though the numbers may be a little dated, I think the data is pretty sound. The premise is pretty sound. And that is that most people get into law enforcement because they've had a connection to it or because someone in law enforcement has encouraged them to do so. It's not because they saw some commercial on TV or because they saw some slick ad or they saw something on social media. It's because someone took a personal interest and said, you know, maybe you have the qualities to come over. And the problem we have today is not so much of a recruiting problem as it is a retention problem. Law enforcement officers don't feel that what they're doing is valued and that they're respected for doing it. And until we address that problem, you're right. The example you gave of law enforcement officers who, you know, careers, their generations have been encouraging their kids not to come into it. This is really creating, existential threat to law enforcement and our ability to be able to get the best and brightest in the next wave of law enforcement to be the evolution of law enforcement. So it's a challenge. That's, you know, getting off the track here. I want to get back to what we're talking about, the crime within cities and how I appreciate exactly what you're saying. I think a lot of these decisions were done quickly in trying to find a way to fix what they perceived as a major problem in a country. And I'm not saying that there's not a foundation of what they have, but law enforcement didn't happen overnight. It evolved over time and has certain elements to it that allow the test of time to have experiences. So we find ourselves what we do, and I like to refer to them as knee-jerk reaction on a lot of these changes in legislation, state legislatures across the country, that in hindsight, we're seeing the damage that's done to these cities. I mean, the data, data is impersonal. It doesn't care whether you like it or not. It's just telling you what the truth is. And there's something to be told there. And there's a number of these programs that we know that are just not, although they may have been well-intended, they're certainly not making our communities more safe. What do you see for the future of that? I mean, at what point do we continue to beat our head against the wall, recognizing that every single one of those numbers I just gave you and these statistics, they're real people?
Right. And it is the policy area where we have the smallest margin for error, right? If we get tax policy wrong, we can correct it, and there's probably some damage that was done, but we can deal with it. If we get education policy wrong, it can be really detrimental, but we can fix it. If we get public safety policy wrong and there's an increase in homicides, there's literally no coming back from it, right? And one of the things that folks don't understand is that so much of homicide, especially when you're talking about urban violence, is interpersonal in why it occurs, right? In the academic literature, we refer to it as the three R's sometimes: respect, reputation, retaliation. So the reason for the homicide is somebody disrespects you, somebody's trying to build a reputation for themselves, or it's retaliation for a previous homicide. And so if you have 50 homicides and 100 shootings, well, then you've got 150 potential instances of retaliation. Well, if the next year you've got 100 homicides and 200 shootings, now you have 300 potential instances of retaliation. And so the stuff tends to build on itself absent meaningful intervention. And so I think what you're seeing around the country in jurisdictions that are not so ideologically bought into what I was talking about earlier, that it is in fact the system that causes people to commit crime, and if you tear it away, then everything will be better. Outside of those areas that are fully bought into that ideology, I think you're starting to see some reverse course, and I think you're starting to see people look for innovative solutions and best practices. When it comes to violence in cities in particular, we have a lot of really solid data. We have a lot of really solid research, because as long as people have congregated in cities, there's been violence in cities. And so we've tried a lot of things. Some things have worked, some things haven't. And so we actually have a pretty good idea of how to meaningfully reduce violence in cities through a myriad of different policy options. And so we can and should fix this. It's a big part of what I do in my day job is produce research and work with city and state level policymakers to try to change these things, reverse course in some instances, or make a city more safe in some instances. Miami, Florida, for example, has weathered the last several years really, really well, actually. They have not seen the increases that many other cities have seen, but they still want to be more safe. They want to improve the quality of life in Miami even more so. And then there are other cities like Jacksonville, just a little bit north, that have really struggled over the last couple of years, that are looking around saying like, nope, we need to get it together. We need to make sure that we are a safe city.
Yeah, you know, Josh, look at the lack of consequences, lack of respect to law. You put it any one of these buckets that you'd like to, what the cause is. But let's talk about some of the data that I think is important for us to recognize, because in a lot of ways, we're not serving or not helping many of the very communities that we insist that we're trying to. And I'll give you an example. From 2011 to 2020, the percentage of violent crime where blacks were the victims were increased from 3% to 33%. And that same percentage is increased in homicides. So we see a disproportion. And a lot of that has to do with poverty. There's a lot of factors involved in it. There's no question about it. But at the same time, this whole discussion of reimagining policing in a lot of ways has proven to be detrimental to this process. I don't think that there's not a single person in law enforcement who truly gets it. and wants to be part of a solution here. And nobody took this job because they don't recognize that there's an evolution in what we do. And it's great to have these open discussions and find ways to adjust and move forward, build just to move forward. That's our very existence as law enforcement. But in reality, look at some of the problems that we're finding. The data doesn't lie. We're not being effective in curbing crime. When you see that much of an increase, there's a statement there. What can be done? I know we don't talk about it enough. A lot of times we'll take the race out of it and we'll talk about these numbers, but really these are the communities that are struggling the most. They're the ones that are suffering. So, a lot of times we argue that these are the ones that we're trying to help. Well, maybe we're not hitting the mark here. Can you unpack that a little bit and give me your thoughts?
Yeah, absolutely. It is absolutely our most vulnerable communities who have been most impacted by this. That's just as true of urban Black communities as it is of rural white communities. You saw a pretty sharp increase in violence over the last couple of years, homicides in particular, in rural white communities. But affluent white suburbs, affluent white dominant suburbs really didn't. They largely got safer over this time period. And so, again, it's an instance in which we know what works from a strategy standpoint. We know what works from a policy standpoint, and it's about implementation. Some of that is a personnel question, right? There's sort of best practice for what the caseload should be for an average homicide detective. Most large city police departments across the country over the last couple of years, those caseloads have gotten out of control because they didn't adequately staff those units relative to what they were seeing for increases in homicide. So they're basically telling the same number of guys, look, you had 100 homicides last year. We got 140 homicides this year. You're just going to have to pick up the extra weight. And the problem with that is it leads to lower homicide clearance rates. And homicide clearance rates are a really good indication of how legitimate law enforcement is viewed in the community, right? So if you are in one of these high poverty communities of color in a city, and you see that only 17% of the homicides in your community have been solved, are you going to be particularly inclined to talk to law enforcement if you see something? Because the truth is, the perpetrator is going to be more omnipresent in your neighborhood, and the perpetrator's friends are going to be more omnipresent in your neighborhood than law enforcement is to begin with. But if on top of that, you don't see those cases being cleared, you don't see those arrests being made, then you've got every reason in the world to sit on your hands and say, nope, I have no idea what happened here, right? And so that really ends up impacting those communities. And so things like adequately staffing your homicide division can go a long way in helping some of that. Strategies that we know work, what's referred to as focused deterrent strategies that focus on these gangs and groups that are committing most of this violence, and that focuses on those groups in a way that sort of the rest of the community feels engaged and heard and all these kinds of things, because there is no one, absolutely no one, no advocate, no officer, no politician who wants the violence to stop in a community with a high rate of violence as much as the people who actually live there, right? And they know who the perpetrators are. They know who the problem people are. And when they see the problem people get taken off the street and they don't see a bunch of negative interactions with law enforcement, then that goes a long way in improving community police relations and goes a long way in them feeling confident in talking to law enforcement down the line about things. And so part of it is that if you build it, they will come, right? If you start to deliver results, you start to get better cooperation, but your policies and your staffing decisions will ultimately impact that.
Yeah, I want to go a little bit further, what you're talking about, the quality of life within communities and I guess opportunities as well. And, I've had the opportunity over the last year and a half to have a lot of discussions with large corporations reaching out, trying to find solutions to the problems they have with theft, to the point where we see businesses in some of these most vulnerable communities pulling out of those communities. So you could argue that quality of life has, in a lot of ways, has nothing to do with law enforcement. It has everything to do with law enforcement. And quality of life is not just, we're just, law enforcement is one aspect of it. The quality of life within a community is the accessibility to to certain services, to certain stores, you know, just to, you know, in essence, the ability to be able to thrive within your community. And so at the same time, it has everything to do with law enforcement, because what we're seeing is these businesses are saying it's just not profitable. And in some cases, we have businesses saying that I can't with a good conscience put my employees in that situation. You recently wrote an op-ed about this very topic, and one that that is not exclusive. It's happening in cities across this country. And it's very interesting perspective. I ask you to just to kind of unpack that a little bit and talk about this dynamic we have of the harm that we're doing. As much further, you know, it's at what point does it become almost a, you know, no turning back? We need to recognize that some of these things are just creating such an unstable environment that it is actually creating a problem on all levels, not just in the law enforcement, in a policing perspective on it, but the entire quality of life within our communities.
Yet people often misunderstand the relationship between poverty and violence, right? There's really mixed research on poverty contributing to violence. There's some evidence, pretty good evidence actually, about poverty contributing to property crime, which makes sense, right? You don't have money, you steal something to sell for some money. Violence, by contrast, doesn't necessarily have that nexus. What is much more clear is the nexus that violence contributes to poverty and sustained poverty within communities. And that's because if you look at two communities, one with very, very similar communities demographically, one with a low rate of violence, one with a high rate of violence, the economic mobility among the poorest residents in the community with the high rate of violence is going to be much, much lower than the economic mobility among that poorest group of residents in the community with a low rate of violence. And that's because we see in communities with high rates of violence, and as rates of violence increase in communities, you see decreased private sector job growth, you see decreased expansion of business, you see the closing of businesses. And so you see that for large corporations, they'll move because they can. And for mom and pop shops that just can't afford, or to the point that you made, don't feel comfortable bringing people into work when there's a substantial risk of being victimized, they'll close up shop or they'll go elsewhere or they'll do something else. And that decreases the opportunity for the residents of that community to not only get cheap goods and services, but to work their way up the economic ladder through jobs and things like that. And so in a community where this happens, you see the significant reduction in opportunity and the significant reduction in upward mobility. And so really, when you're talking about trying to improve a community, violence is the first thing you should address, not the last, right? So sometimes you'll hear people say like, oh, well, if we address poverty and we address education, we do these kinds of things, then violence will decrease. The reverse is true. You address violence first, you restore order in the community to a place where people feel comfortable, going out, especially people feel comfortable going out at night once the sun goes down, kind of thing. Then you could talk about serious investment in a community for the long-term success of that community. But it's remarkably difficult to make a community more prosperous while it has a high rate of violence.
And Josh, you recently wrote an op-ed, and one quote in it. In any given city, typically less than 1% of the city's population is responsible for 50% of the homicides. And there are a lot of factors there. You elaborate on it. Can you share a little bit of that op-ed, your position, and why that is important, and some of the remedies of trying to reverse course on this?
Yeah, absolutely. So nowhere in America is there truly a high crime community. And what I mean by that is nowhere in the United States is there a community where a majority or even a large minority of residents are seriously criminally involved. It's a very small number of people who are committing a large percentage of the violence. And when you talk about homicides in particular, you're typically talking about just over 0.5% of your city's population that's committing more than 50% of your homicides. That typically takes place within the subcontext of street gangs or street groups. For the listeners who might not know, a street group walks like a gang, talks like a gang, acts like a gang, just doesn't meet sort of official definitions of what constitutes a gang. So it could be that they're not hierarchical. It could be that the numbers are small. It could be that people come and go, but it's effectively the same thing. Practically speaking, it's the same thing. Those individuals and the dynamics within those groups tend to drive much of that violence. When you're talking about violent crime more broadly, so not just homicides, you're talking typically about 5% of offenders. So not 5% of your population, 5% of offenders that are responsible for 50% of your violence. You're also talking about geographic concentration. It's typically between 2 and 5% of one block street segments in a city that are responsible for more than 50% of crime. And there are characteristics of those blocks that are, tend to be pretty predictive. Abandoned buildings, overgrown vacant lots, inadequate street lighting, sort of physical disorder like that tends to attract that kind of crime. And so when you think about policing a whole city, right, it's a relatively daunting task when you think about, you know, hundreds of thousands of people and all these businesses and all these places. But when you start to think about the small number of offenders that are driving the violence, the small number of groups that are driving the violence, and the small number of micro locations that are driving the violence, it becomes much more palpable to deal with, and it becomes a much more straightforward project.
Josh, let's talk about some of these brazing, I mean, really brazing crimes we're seeing in cities across this country. How do we combat that? The system, you're correct. We need to find ways to be more efficient within a system. But the reality is it's hard to do these things without recognizing that we're not empowering that small segment because of some of these very policies that are trying, they're well-intended, but they're having an adverse consequences on an even smaller percentage. And we're seeing more brazing crimes. Look, we talked about the murder rate. That murder rate is probably 1/4 of what, or probably even less than the amount of people who are shot. It's not, you know, so the violence is much higher. Murder rate could be a lot higher if it wouldn't be for modern medicine and a number of things. The violence is increasing. It's increasing. Look, just in law enforcement officers, any amount of law enforcement officers that were shot in 2022, we've had one of our most deadly years. Out of that, a small percentage actually were killed from those those actions. But that doesn't mean that potentially there could have been 331 that were killed. So let's just unpack this: the policies versus empowering a small segment that is becoming more and more brazen.
Yeah. So the short answer to that is the way you deal with it is accountability, right?
Right.
And so your policies have to reflect that, and then your practice has to reflect that, right? The criminal justice system is based, like the primary function of the criminal justice system is to apprehend, prosecute, and incapacitate criminal wrongdoers, right? That's the purpose of it. The secondary purpose is to the extent possible to reduce crime through policy. And then while we do all those things, we want them done justly, we want them done fairly, we want them done equitably, all those kinds of things. But the primary purpose of the criminal justice system is to apprehend, prosecute, and incapacitate criminal wrongdoers. And in too many jurisdictions across the country, that has been confused or that has been warped. What will ultimately get the most brazen to respond the way we want them to is accountability of their friends, of their associates, of other people who are doing the kinds of things that they're doing. The reason that you see that carjacking has kind of exploded out of nowhere. It's one of the more interesting phenomena that has happened over the last couple of years. All of a sudden, carjackings start going up in a number of cities across the country. There's sort of this social media culture that develops among some of these young carjackers. And so it starts to build on itself. But as soon as jurisdictions started to really clamp down on it, it started to go away some because the risk wasn't worth the reward. A carjacking, unlike sort of a car theft, is the car is very rarely the the prize in a carjacking, right? Like, people aren't carjacking BMWs and Mercedes and things like that. They're carjacking either to go commit another crime, typically a drive-by shooting with the car, or to get clout on social media, build a reputation, those kinds of things. If it's the latter, and all of a sudden it's not worth it anymore because there's a federal mandatory minimum that's going to attach if you're arrested and prosecuted for carjacking, and it's done in a deliberate and meaningful way, you've seen those numbers start to retreat considerably in the cities that have taken it seriously. And I think that's generally true across the board. So when offenders are held accountable, it sends a message across the board. Not that we're ever going to get to zero, but the sort of brazen nature of some of this starts to dissipate.
You know, Josh, you know, the Fraternal Order Police has been signaling alarm for quite some time about rogue prosecutors who are basically legislating from their position as prosecution. And their premise is that the entire criminal justice system is somehow racially unjust, you know, unjust. And they feel that there's a need to reverse engineer the criminal justice system. But we're seeing consequences across this country. And I know you've been outspoken on this. Can you talk about how the lack of consequences from these, although it might sound well-intended, efforts to try and improve the criminal justice system is having such a profound impact?
Yeah. Part of it is that some of these folks started with sort of the low-hanging fruit. Do you think that anybody should be in prison for simple possession of marijuana? And the general answer from the American people to that question in 2022, 2020 is no, right? And so they say, okay, what we're going to do is we're not going to prosecute those cases because you don't believe that it should be illegal. And the fact that the legislature hasn't acted is not a good enough reason. I'm going to use my discretion to not do that. And then they said, okay, we're going to look at these other things, and we're going to move away from an incarceration model. And what we're going to try to do is we're going to get these people into treatment, and we're going to deal with the underlying cause of whatever these things is. Nobody's stealing a bunch of baby formula because they want to steal a bunch of baby formula. They're doing it because they're a drug addict and so on and so forth. And within all of that are sort of nuggets of truth, right? We don't, as a general rule, incarcerate a lot of those folks. We arrest plenty of those folks, and then oftentimes we'll leverage an incarceration to try to get some of those folks in a treatment. And then some of those individuals earn sort of lifetime achievement awards and end up in prison because they've been arrested so many times, and there's no other way to deal with this person than to try to get them some sort of treatment within the confines of a prison. And so those things are going on, but then you saw some of these prosecutors come in and say, okay, no more enhancements, no more gang enhancements in San Francisco, right? We're not going to seek the death penalty anymore, regardless of the circumstances. We're not going to prosecute unlawful possession of a firearm the way we otherwise would, right? Well, now you're talking about really serious conduct and criminal actors who tend to be more rational because they don't have some of those underlying substance abuse issues. These are your more serious offenders. These are your guys who are actively involved in street life, who respond to the incentives around them. And so if all of a sudden this behavior is no longer going to be punished the way it was a couple of years ago, well, guess what? You're going to get more of that behavior now. And so I think you saw a lot of these prosecutors appeal to some people's base sympathies about what they believe and then turn around and do some really, really radical things as it relates to serious offenders. And now you're seeing the consequences in some of these jurisdictions. But it got so bad in a place like San Francisco that is as progressive as anywhere in the country. You saw especially Asian Americans, because of the rate at which Asian American victimization went up during the time period of that DA's term, turn around and say, no, absolutely not, unacceptable. This isn't some embrace of sort of old school tough on crime policies, but this is a bridge way too far for us. And so I think you're starting to see a little bit more of that across the country because it has been a disaster.
Josh, there's another side to this that I think it really doesn't get a whole lot of discussion. We talk about the, you know, the need to have the deterrences and how of crime, and how in a lot of cases we've minimized the exposure to that. But I would argue that there's a side we don't talk about. People don't go from 0 to 60 in a second. It's a progression in crime. And when there is an intervention early on and there are consequences with it, what we do is we stop that progression. That person who you might have seen, what you call a minor violation, that interaction may have had some positive impact, which have not put them on the path for the most extreme of what we see. And there are cases to show that. Well, we don't talk about that side of it. Often it's not. It's the positive interactions that we've had to change behavior is what's important. And so with that, what I'd like to do is, kind of wrap this up, but I'd like for you to talk a little bit about maybe your vision on what policies do work. What do we need to do? I mean, we spent the first part of this podcast talking about things that don't work. How can we recognize that? And I agree with you. Somebody's stealing baby formula. They're not doing it because they're a criminal. They're doing it because they've got a reason. Some of those outlying factors, the reason it may have done it might be criminally, connected. But it is something that we need to address. That's not who the criminal justice system is looking for. What we're trying to stop that violent crime across this country. And it all starts when enforcing laws, even as simple as you think they may be, and in some cases think they're not. Talk about some of the policies that you see that could have a meaningful impact on improving the relationship. It is a relationship between the community and those who police it, those who are responsible for the criminal justice system.
Yeah. So law enforcement is always going to be your single most important factor when it comes to the reduction of violence in a community. And so adequately funding, staffing, supporting law enforcement, right? That's not to say blindly supporting law enforcement. That's not to say when a true misdeed takes place that officer's not held accountable. But one of the mistakes that a lot of departments have made across the country, they've made some of them here in Louisville, is rather than hold an individual accountable for what was a true misdeed, they've changed departmental policy because of those misdeeds, and it's led to some of these increases. So adequately funding, staffing, supporting law enforcement, and then within that, making sure that your strategy reflects what works, right? I mentioned focused deterrent strategies earlier. They were pioneered in Boston in the 1990s. They've been implemented all over the country. And when you're talking about gang and group violence, they are the gold standard for how to reduce that by focusing on those groups, focusing on the group as a group, as a group entity, because that's part of the problem is the group dynamics that contribute to the violence. If you and I see each other on the street and you scuff my shoe, I may be inclined to let it go. But if you and I see each other on the street and you scuff my shoe and I've got three or four of my friends with me and they start to say, you're going to let them get away with that. You're going to let them disrespect you like that, things like that. And so that is one of the meaningful things. Adequately staffing homicide units is really important. And then making sure that your sentencing structure reflects the seriousness of the charge, right? There have been a number of sentencing reforms that have taken place over the last couple of years. Some of that has been really positive, again, to try to leverage treatment and things like that for people who have those problems. But when you're talking about serious violent offenders, making sure that people are being incapacitated for the appropriate amount of time to make the community safer. One of the things that we're going to be looking at here in the next couple of months is for homicide cases in particular, basically the amount of time that an individual is sentenced to versus the amount of time that they actually end up serving, right? And the preliminary look at that data is pretty jarring, that for what is the most serious of offenses, the offense that we would all agree is the unlawful taking of a human life is unacceptable. There's really not a debate on that question. The time sentenced versus the time served is remarkably different. And so you imagine as you work your way down the ladder, just how different that gets as well, even when you're talking about other serious violent offenses. And then what I refer to as sort of pre-entry and re-entry, right? Especially when you're talking about juveniles and young adults who may have sort of one foot in civil society, one foot in street life. There have been a number of sort of softer ways to engage with those individuals, cognitive behavioral therapy programs, especially that are a part of something more comprehensive with some supervision and stuff like that, has been really effective in helping young people get out of gang life and leave gang life behind. And then one of the biggest problems in this country is that we are remarkably bad at making sure that somebody comes out of prison better than they went in, right? There was an analysis done a number of years ago that in 24 states, 10 years after release, more than 80% of the people who had been released had been rearrested. And so there are some gold standard reentry programs across the country. But the truth is that a lot of jurisdictions are spending a lot of money on reentry programs that either aren't working, or we have no idea if they work, or that they need to be evaluated. And so jurisdictions need to start to evaluate those programs meaningfully. If they don't work, we need to get rid of them and move on. We need to be experimental, and we need to try to adapt some of those programs that do work in the jurisdictions that they work more broadly, because an 80% recidivism rate like that just means more victims.
Well, I appreciate your insight, and we've got a lot of work to do ahead of us. But when everyone agrees to working towards a better solution, I have no doubt that we'll get there. We just got to get everybody on board to be rational and let data help us guide us where we are. Josh, for our viewers, if they want to know more about the Center for Opportunity, Georgia Center for Opportunity, tell us where they would. What's the best way to go about getting that information?
Yeah, so the website is foropportunity.org, Georgia Center for Opportunity on all social media. I don't have the stomach for Twitter, but you could follow me on Instagram. It's jcrawford502. That's where I do most of the posting, interact with people to talk about these issues.
No, Josh, thank you for joining us on the podcast, and I appreciate your insight on these issues. Very informative. And like I said, we got a lot of work to do. And to our listeners, thank you for tuning into the Blue View podcast, where we talk about the issues that are so vitally important to the men and women who suit up and show up every day in communities across this country. Thank you.
Be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere else you get your podcasts. To get the latest from the National FOP, make sure to follow us on Twitter and Facebook at GLFOP. And on Instagram at FOP National. Thanks again. We'll see you next time.